You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Emissary. I'm James from London.
I'm Lou from Nebraska, and...
I am the Klingon Comptoir from Indiana.
Indiana, where on Kronos is that?
It's in the middle of the mountain range.
Nice. The Klingon, Brian Denimore. So how are you, Brian? You were on for season one. Let me find it real quick.
Heart of Glory.
Heart of Glory, where you gave it a 3, and James and I gave it a 4. And normally I would ask, so why did you want to come on this episode? But since I drafted you for it.
No, you didn't draft. You went and found the best Klingon that would come on and do Klingon shows for you for TNG.
You got it, because I've already got you on next year or next season for The Bonding and Sins of the Father. So you didn't have to ask. You're just on. What does a Klingon do when he's not doing glorious things for the Empire?
Micromanaging and enjoying his granddaughter.
Tell us about the granddaughter part.
Yes. Born March 20th, which was supposed to be our last week's taping. We're doing it this week. Born at 8:30 in the evening. Her name is Carmen.
Beautiful name.
Carmen Leanne. And she was born 7 pounds, 7 ounces, and 20 inches long. And she's as ornery as her grandfather. Oh. I'm going to enjoy myself.
Is this your first grandchild?
This is my, well, I only have one child, but I have several kids that I've helped raise at various times in their lives, so this is technically my 5th grandkid.
Ah!
This is my first grandkid by my own children. I have 2 from my last marriage. I have one that's one that I first raised back when I was younger. He has a daughter, and then... My heir apparent to my Klingon dynasty, he has a son.
Cool. Okay, well, it's good to have you on, and hopefully we have a pretty good show online tonight. So, all right, go ahead, Doc.
Okay, well, just please send congratulations down to your, to the extended family on the safe delivery of the new little nipper.
Yeah.
Yes, I will, Doc.
Yep, she's already here.
She's already here.
No, sure. Do you guys use the word nipper in the U.S.?
Not often.
There's a bar called Little Nippers, but...
Okay, let's roll on. So the synopsis for tonight's show is the Enterprise crew has to deal with a Klingon sleeper ship whose occupants don't know the Federation and the Klingons are at peace. On board to help them is an emissary who... coincidentally, is one of Worf's former love interests. This is the 20th episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and it was originally aired on the 29th of June, 1989. It was written by Richard Manin, Hans Beimler, and Thomas Calder, and directed by Cliff Boll. Tonight's episode features a special guest appearance by Dinah Muldow as Dr. Pulaski, and guest stars Susie Plaxton as Kayla, Lance Legault as Cuttermore, Jogan Johnson as Gromek, and of course everyone's favorite transporter chief, Cole Meany as Miles O'Brien. So what do we think about this episode? And if I could go first, I don't ever recall particularly liking this when I was younger. I didn't think I really got the love interest story. But, you know, critically watching it this time, I thought it held up very well as an episode. And I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So over to you, Lou.
Oh, let's let the guests go next.
Over to you, Brian.
Gee, thanks. It's been a while. I got brushed off the cobwebs here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this, we didn't know much about the Klingons back when this episode came out. So I kind of found it interesting to look at the what we call the mating ritual.
Yeah.
It's one version of the mating ritual. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that we got a chance to see Susie plays something other than a Vulcan doctor, which I think she does later on in other episodes. But it was nice to see the interaction between a Klingon female and a Klingon male, even though I thought it was kind of cheesy between it. But overall, it was a good Klingon fill-in episode that really just had some fun with it. Mm-hmm. But towards the end of it, I really like what Worf came up with to deal with the sleeper ship. And he did a pretty good job doing what he had to do. I was quite pleased with him.
Okay. Well, my turn then. Well, it has to be since I'm last. It's an interesting premise. I like the premise. I love the idea of the sleeper ship Klingons coming out of stasis. However, they had to bring in the love interest of Worf, and I think that put a little poo-poo on it, actually. If it had been all about the Klingons, I think it could have been interesting, a cat-and-mouse game with the Enterprise. But I think they messed it up by not bringing Kalar. I do love Susie's performance. But as far as the love interest thing and trying to mate, and I think it kind of ruined what could have been an excellent story.
Well, you got to take in mind, you got to look at Worf and Kalar. Their relationship is, at best, it's more like a couple of sword fighters fighting in a duel. It's they don't always seem to get along, and they don't always seem to, they can't seem to agree on anything. And it's always after they've had their fights that they realize that, hey, maybe we ought to just do this right, but they never seem to do it. And I feel sorry for Worf because he really does like this girl. And I kind of like, I would have loved to have seen Susie stayed on for a season or more playing this character, but they offed her off, so I can't do nothing about it. But I do like what I did see of the interaction, but after this show aired and a few years after that is when you actually find out more of their history together. And and when we first saw this, we didn't have that background information back then. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So before we go into tonight's episode, we do have some forum feedback for Q Who is where we left off, and that was the one that I also tacked on the little tribute to Leonard Nimoy. And Funky Psy 1701. And Simon says
boom boom.
Okay, he says, I really enjoyed the tribute to Leonard Nimoy you open up with. Thank you. And as I scanned down, I think he's the only one that really said anything about that. So thank you, Simon. I appreciate it. It was last minute. Q Who is a favorite of mine. I even picked it as one of my Desert Island Treks. I'm a big fan of the Borg, and this is probably my second favorite episode, Borg episode, after The Best of Both Worlds. Agreed. It certainly isn't the Hugh one. I love the way, although I do love Hugh, but I don't like the subsequent Hugh and lore one. I love the way that this episode starts off with a fun Q episode and turns far more serious when we realize how dangerous the Borg are. Q has some great lines in the end as the Enterprise is fleeing the Borg. You can't outrun them. You can't... You know, I'll tell you what. I'll just put in the audio at this point.
You can't outrun them. You can't destroy them. If you damage them, the essence of what they are remains. They regenerate and keep coming. Eventually, you will weaken. Your reserves will be gone. They are relentless.
Okay, he goes on to say, I don't have the Blu-rays, but slicing into the hull special effects still looks good today, 20 years later. And he does ask a question. If hot chocolate shouldn't be in engineering, why did the Enterprise designers place a replicator in engineering?
The replicator there is to replicate things like spanners, yes, and other stuff you're going to need in engineering. I assume they don't need spanners. But so I think people are just trying to use it for inappropriate things. And in this case, hot chocolate is inappropriate.
That's a good point.
Okay, so let me go on to Data Logan. And he states that Captain Picard's quarters are on Deck 9, right at the front of the saucer section of the ship, right above the 10 forward lounge. But we do know from power play that there is at least some Jefferies tubes above 10 forward that are still below the captain's quarters. So he has at least some sound dampening from the bar below during his below his sleeping quarters. By the way, it was established that Riker's quarters are on Deck 8, so not the same batch of officers' quarters on Deck 9 that was mentioned in this episode. Kieran follows that up by saying, but is there enough soundproofing between Riker's quarters and everyone that might not want to hear his extracurricular activities?
That was a short one from Kieran McDuff this week. Ha ha ha.
He comes back.
He'll be back. He'll be back, y'all. Okay, so Data comes on with two more. I'm not sure if he just had more thoughts or what, but anyway, he says the whole concept of when faster than light, no left or right, only appeared in one bad episode of Voyager, and maybe Star Trek Into Darkness, depending on how you interpret the visuals. Throughout the rest of Trek, is generally accepted that many different maneuvers can be done at warp speed. It's just a faster speed. You are pretty still much in the same universe and able to do anything you would be able to do at some light speeds. Just you can see everything around you while in warp by using sensors. That idea was forgotten in the 2009 Star Trek movie. Besides, the whole idea of straight warp flying with no turns is a confusing one anyway. Straight lines are not how you generally travel in space, at least not at sublight. You are much more concerned about navigating levels of gravitational potential energy. That's why, for instance, you should have read this, by the way, since you're the doctor on that stuff. If you're on the revolving satellite and want to get to another revolving around the same point, say a planet or a star, the quickest way and most energy efficient way to travel between the two satellites would not be a direct line, but by speeding up or slowing down in order to change a different orbit that would intersect the other satellite. Efficient travel in a solar system involves a lot of ellipticals, not straight lines. I think that warp travel would probably be similar, just on a larger scale. Your opinions on that?
I think, okay, so everything he's spoken about so far is correct in terms of certainly when you're maneuvering through the solar system and effectively when he's talking about gravitational potential energy, he's talking about effectively using the gravity and how that impacts you as a way of being able to get around the system. So it's not the case that you do go in straight lines. You kind of try to keep your movements so that you keep the same potential energy. It's just, you know, that's the more appropriate way to handle it in this case. Now, when you move into the issue of warp in particular, where as far as I've kind of worked out in my head, you're supposed to be bending the space-time continuum. I mean, the space-time continuum itself is non-Euclidean, which means there are no kind of concepts of straight lines, or at least in how we would describe it, in terms of what you can write down on a graph paper and stuff. So I really don't buy this idea of went faster than light, no left or right. I think it doesn't sound right, because you're warping to space-time itself. You know, what does it mean, no left or right, if you have the ability to warp space-time?
Okay. Well, he then goes on to say, I think Riker may have been right in his thought that at least some Borg are born. Maybe Borg ships, I don't know how they could be born. Maybe Borg ships on the edge of Borg space that spend their time interacting with non-Borg species could assimilate enough new beings to grow their ranks. But what about the Borg society way of center of the Borg space? What if they need new drones because sometimes the old ones wear out? It's only logical to think at least sometimes Borg may choose to grow new drones themselves. Oh, I can't disagree anymore. I cannot see reproduction on a Borg ship. I think it's purely assimilation.
You mean like no Borg Nookie?
No Borg Nookie. Why don't you meet me at my alcove later tonight? No, I seriously don't think so. Can you even conceptualize reproduction on a Borg ship?
Are we including Seven of Nine in this discussion?
Well, not? As Seven of Nine, not as Annika Hansen.
I don't know. I haven't really thought about this too much. I think that... Okay, I suppose from a Borg perspective, what's more efficient? So if you needed new drones, is it more efficient to go and find them and effectively bring them into the collective, or is it more efficient to grow them? And I would imagine it's probably more efficient to assimilate them, but at the same time, having an ability to grow them is an option. So I don't know. I'm not particularly fussed either way.
Mm. Plan B. I don't know. I mean, is 7 of 42 and 16 of 39 the proud parents of 24 of 28? I mean, it makes no sense. I can't see it at all. So obviously, obviously this isn't directly explained in the episode because the writers hadn't thought ahead and hadn't come up with the idea of Borg assimilation. In this first Borg episode, the Borg really don't care about the alien bodies they encounter, only their technology. These Borg don't assimilate people at all. Heck, even in Best of Both Worlds, the Borg didn't seem to bother assimilating anyone other than Picard, and they did that only to add his voice and knowledge to their ranks. In fact, he says, maybe Picard assimilation is the very moment that the Borg learn how to assimilate at all. No. Maybe they never did this before, but only when they choose to with Picard, they learn how useful it could be. Yes, even though they lost the encounter and then decide to use it more later on, eventually becoming almost obsessed with it as a primary method of assimilating more technological advances and drone bodies. No. Data, I think you're completely off the mark on this particular feedback because there's no way they just said, hey, this assimilation stuff is kind of cool. Let's do it again. And then they transmitted that to the entire collective. Hey, if you were to do this, you can add to our ranks. That would mean that reproduction was the only way the Borg society grew. No way. Not a chance.
Now, by the way, I am kind of sympathetic to the idea that the Borg that you see in Q-Who do not necessarily assimilate, or at least do not necessarily go after people to assimilate. So I think that, I don't necessarily, I actually never even noticed that they didn't at this stage, but then later they do. I thought that was a natural enough extension of their character that didn't really grate with me. However, we kind of do know that they do assimilate, right? Because, Seven of Nine's parents were assimilated, and that would have been before the Q-Who time. Mm-hmm. And so we have seen this in play. I kind of like the idea that potentially when I try to work it out in my mind, I always assume that they had very high standards to begin with, right? So they meet the Enterprise, they say that it's, one of the best ships they've ever come across, and they go, we like a bit of the technology, but we're not going to touch the people. And then by the time you're onto Voyager or whatever, they're trying to assimilate Kazon and all of the rest of the backward species they come across because there's a real, labor shortage or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
No, I think that first ship was just a scout ship, or the first Borg that came aboard was a scout Borg. He just wants to see what's going on over there, take a little bit of their technology and their computer systems, and then come after them later. Why else were they trying to catch up with them? It wasn't. I don't necessarily believe they were trying to destroy the Enterprise. I think they just saw 1,000 new drones, and that's why they went after them.
No, I think that's certainly, you can read that into it. And you do have, you're absolutely right that you do have the chase at the end. And I don't think that's chasing for the sole purpose of blowing up the ship. Or losing the ship in a battle or something.
Plus, the Federation and the Romulans lost a bunch of outposts along the neutral zone. They were all just scooped up. Where did they go? Did they just eat them and then get rid of them? Scoop them up, and what'd they do with them? Obviously, they assimilated them. And the technology.
All right. Okay, so let me move on to Kieran McDuff, who was clearly off the mark this week and was unable to get in the first four posts, astonishingly. So he comes up with, I absolutely love this episode. It has Q, and I enjoy all of his episodes. Yes, even the relatively poor Deep Space Nine one. John Delancey does a great job of selling an omnipotent being who seems like he's a threat, but he actually wants to help. It's never more obvious than in this episode. Now, just going off the post there, I really agree with that statement. I really do like John Delancey and how he portrays it in this way, and I'm pretty sure I raised this when we were speaking of Q. And I'd also throw out things like, okay, Tapestry certainly he is helping, and it's very obvious that he's helping, but then the question is that Q or is that just Picard's imagination? But then also, All Good Things, it's, I always read that as completely as Q helping out humanity to, you know, make the next steps. Mm-hmm. Okay, but more than, so carrying on with Kieran's comment, but more than that, this episode introduces the new Star Trek bad guy that actually frightened me. The Klingons, the Romulans, they were decent bad guys, yes, but the Borg were a species that actually made sense to me in a way that I could easily imagine them coming out of a science fiction and into reality. It's not just funny humans with ridges or pointed ears. They're linked together by technology in an effort to improve efficiency of a species as a whole. They're the ultimate answer to the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. Add to that the fact that they proved to be a match only for a short time before they use their collective power to adapt to whatever you can throw at them, and it soon becomes evident that you can't win against them. The Borg will defeat you in the end, unless Q can step in and help you, that is. The main story is brilliant from start to finish. The to and fro with Q to begin with, where you expect another jaunty tale, the debate between Q and Picard as he shows off Starfleet's will to explore, the arrogance of wanting to show Q that they're not afraid to see what's out there, the pacing of the curiosity as we slowly learn what the Borg are, the draw dropping, carving up like a roast of the Enterprise saucer section, the relentless pursuit towards the end as the Enterprise gets ground down to an inevitable defeat, and then Picard's groveling to Q at the end to save them. Just as you think it's all over, the truth bomb of they will be coming restores all that fear that you've just built up in those 45 minutes and leaves it hanging there. Absolutely brilliant. You can put this episode together with the best of both worlds with a suitable gap of time, of course, and it tells a terrifically scary story, one that I don't think Star Trek has come close to matching since, not even with First Contact, which might have had a better budget to make the Borg even scarier, but ultimately it's not quite as well done, and it's actually the undoing of the Borg as they move into Voyager.
Yeah, I kind of agree. They neutered the Borg for Voyager.
But that shouldn't take away from just how good these early Borg stories were. Now, actually, I have to say that just coming on about the issue about it being a terrifying story, I remember watching DS9, and I also thought that the way that they handled at least the initial phase of the changelings and the uncertainty around that, in particular when you have, you know, the Klingon and the Federation War, and you realize that Martok's a changeling, or at least that's what is thrown out there, and you know there's a lot of that back and forth. I actually thought that was very well done as well.
Yes.
And that's, I think, that's one time when you start thinking, oh, you know, you start very much questioning a lot of the stuff and feeling that you're on an inevitable path to defeat. And I think that's what I originally picked up with the Borg, and I think it didn't come back until certainly those early encounters in the Dominion War storyline.
Oh, yeah.
Because actually, I have to, on a slight tangent, by the time you get into the actual all-out war, right, it's more a firepower thing. You know who the enemy is, and you know where you have to stand. Whereas when they're in the shadows, I found the build-up to be very good.
Oh, right, and then, you know, let me do a tangent now. And then what was the Federation's solution to the Dominion War? The Defiant. And I thought that was kind of lacking, too, because in the first time we see the Defiant, Sisko says, you know, she's got claws, but she's got teeth. And then I thought, yes, but after your first encounter, damn it, she needed dentures. I mean, she had the teeth knocked out of her. The first encounter with the Jem'Hadar and the Defiant, it was not well. So anyway, yeah, I thought the Dominion probably amped up the scary from the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So continue with Kieran's comment. Yes, there was probably a sticking point with the whole they will be coming ending when you consider they are already here according to the Neutral Zone episode. But I'm willing to overlook that and accept how good everything else was in this episode. I'll also overlook the quick demise of Sonia Gomez. I thought she'd be an interesting character, but I suspect they ended up replacing a lot of what they wanted to do with her with Reg Barkley. He also gave Geordi someone over which he could show off his command capabilities without the chance of Geordi trying to have a failed romance. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just exactly where they're going to go with Sonia.
I bet.
I'm not sure what happened with her behind the scenes. All I know is that it definitely all went wrong for poor Sonia when she turned up on... Hang on, does he turn up on Mars in Total Recall with an extra appendage? What's that about?
Obviously, she must have played on Total Recall.
Okay, so I didn't know. Okay. Eccentrica Gallambit style, if you know your Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I do not.
Me either.
Actually, I shouldn't admit bad things like that on the podcast. I have not read the books. I have not watched the radio play, the radio show. I did watch the film that they put out in what, around 2000 or so with the dude from The Office and Zooey Deschanel. But I know that that is horrendous, and it was thought of as being horrendous. So I don't have very good geek creds on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm also happy to overlook the sensor issues, as I tend to agree with Lou. Q probably stole the shuttlecraft in such a way that the sensors wouldn't notice. Mind you, that might not be too difficult. In the future episode Galaxy's Child, Geordi mentions that the computer is notorious for not volunteering information. That probably explains why he doesn't mention the Picard isn't on the ship until someone asks as well. This is easily a 5 out of 5 episode for me. Definitely one I can watch again and again and again. It never gets old. Just a final point on the feedback from the Royale. The casinos in Glasgow are definitely not as glamorous as Las Vegas. Glasgow casinos are usually populated by people who don't want to go home after the pubs and clubs shut. Considering the clubs shut at 3 a.m. and sometimes 4 a.m, that's some heavy-duty stuff. There are very few times I've actually been in them, and it's usually after a stag do, a.k.a. bachelor party. And that would include my own. So thank you very much, Kieran, for that. And thank you for everyone that comments on the forums. We always are grateful to receive feedback. And it's good to know that people are listening and at least participating in the debate.
Or actually, over here, it's actually against law to enter a casino when you're intoxicated. So I don't know about the pubs and crumb call. So, anyway, but that's a different story.
Is that? Why is that the case? Is that because
judgment's impaired?
So is that a way of protecting the individual,
yes,
from his gambling, or a way of protecting the establishment from the from the drunk individual?
I think it's both. That way they're not responsible for them. I mean, you bring somebody who's intoxicated onto your property, are you assuming responsibility for them? If they hurt themselves, they hurt someone else. So and plus, again, like you say, they're judgment's impaired, so therefore should they be gambling?
Now, I know that we're probably running late now, but can I have a small tangent about intoxication?
Especially when they get you intoxicated while you're there. But anyway, go ahead.
So, I remember watching Star Trek when I was young, 11 or so, and I remember that obviously going to school at the time, and I was never the biggest reader in the world, and I specifically remember that growing up, I got a lot of my vocabulary from Star Trek, and in particular, I remember at school when I was around 11, we did have not a test, but I think it came up in a play. I think it comes up in Shakespeare, to be honest. But we were reading, and intoxication came up, and people asked the class, or the teacher asked the class, if anyone knew what was meant by intoxicated. And obviously, it sounds like you have been subject to a toxin of some description. But I remember that in particular, it's mentioned in The Naked Now a lot, that everyone is intoxicated. And I remember being the only person in the class that noted that it specifically referred to alcohol intoxication. And for that, I have to thank Star Trek. Mm. So you learn something. So all the kids who'll be watching Star Trek, getting to be clever, knowing about the space-time continuum and tachyons and stuff like that. Mm. And you do know what a tachyon is, Lou, don't you?
To me, it's a Star Trek word. It's one of those that... is it real, are you saying?
It is real.
It is a real, a tachyon.
Yeah. So a tachyon, within general relativity, you have certain particles that can travel at the speed of light. You have certain particles that travel below the speed of light. And you have certain particles that would, at least from a conceptual point of view, could travel faster than the speed of light. And those are called tachyons.
Okay.
So this is the thing, when you've gone to university and you're kind of like a Trekkie nerd and you learn all of this stuff, and then you turn up into your general relativity class and they say, obviously this part of the diagram here represents the tachyons, and you go, tachyons are real? Wow.
Mm. Wow. So is intoxication. But I do need to correct you on one thing you said, though. For those who actually listened to us in the U.S., he used the word teachers, and we use the word teachers here, but you don't. So why don't you tell them what they're called over there?
I'm sorry, pardon me? A teacher?
No, I thought they were called masters.
Okay, a head teacher will be called a headmaster. That is true. But everyday teachers, they're called teachers.
Oh, I thought it was just... See, now I learned something. Disregard everything I said, guys. I was only, 1/8 correct. Okay, I didn't know I was. Well, because you know where I get it from, actually, is Rowan Atkinson. You do know who he is.
Okay. Absolutely, Mr. Bean.
Mr. Bean. He did a
Blackadder.
Yeah. He did a comedy special where he did several different skits. And one of them was the principal or the headmaster bringing the parent in to let him know that his son has been killed because he did something wrong. And what he said was, it's been weeks since any master had received any work from him. And I think that's where I got that from, is just assuming the teachers were masters and the principal would be the headmaster.
Okay, so that term would probably be applicable to some of the older public schools in the UK. So if we're talking about the very kind of posh, high-end schools. Now, just so I don't confuse anyone in the US or other places around the world, a public school in the UK is a private school that for some reason is called a public school. So typically it would be a very old school that is a fee-paying school and not like a standard school run by the state.
Mm.
And we call those public schools for reasons that I actually do not understand.
So then what are public schools, our public schools over there called?
Well, they would be, usually you'd refer to them as state schools.
Ah. Okay. Some people like it when you school me on things in the UK, so that's interesting. Okay. Well, then I guess we need to go back into the show. So let's go ahead and head on into the emissary. Excellent. Those are the
That was a tangent.
Those are fun, though, when you school me on things. I like those.
It is.
We start off with the poker game. And this time, Dr. Pulaski was invited. And Data bends. I kind of had a problem with the Data bending.
I also have a problem with it. I think that the episode starts a little... Actually, I didn't like the first scene, the poker scene at all, until we actually get to the end, and then you can actually see that there's a little bit of a common thread through, right, with Worf, you know, effectively being the Iceman. So I thought that was a relatively nice callback, but I think we're, you know, Data bending is a little, it's not what they should be doing at this stage. I think it's very season one Data-esque. And I thought the actual scene, the very first scene, I don't think it was quite as tight as it could have been in terms of tying things up. I thought it dragged a little bit. But it's good that at least, you know, that it is throughout season two, right, these poker scenes have become a little bit of a staple of character interaction amongst the crew. And it's, you know, it's good that they keep on going. I think there are better ones than this. Yeah. So I won't judge it too harshly.
Well, I mean, you just got into a poker game. Worf's winning all the chips for once, in a rare occasion. Because usually most of the other poker games, he's not doing too well in the game, but he's actually winning for once. And to kind of like, oh no, the Iceman's winning. You're not going to beat this Klingon. And it's, I think it's kind of cute in its little time frame ending, but... Yeah, it does introduce Worf to how the Iceman works, or how cool Worf can be under pressure and when something needs to be done. I mean, it was a nice intro. And playing poker is always a nice thing when you want to get around people and find out more about them. So you can look at it bad or good. It's me, I kind of run it in the middle.
Okay, well... So what do you guys think they're playing for? I mean, there are obviously chips, but what do the chips represent? They don't have money. We know later in DS9, their currency is gold pressed latinum. But what do you think they would be playing for on the Enterprise? Holodeck time?
Ego.
So just for the fun of it.
Just for the fun of it. Just to relax. Just the poker is one of them things that is a interactive. It's like negotiating for something. Okay, you got to be able to read people and to know whether or not they're bluffing or not, and how to read and know when you think they might have a good hand by what they do, how they react.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up. Know when to walk away. Know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the deal's done.
That's part of the reason why they call Worf the Iceman, because he don't very seldom react to his cards. Okay, he just sits there like
yes.
A block of ice.
But still, what are they playing for? What's the ultimate win?
Nothing, just the ego, the prestige of saying, yeah, I won it. I won this week at the poker table.
Doc?
Well, I think Worf's playing for honor, right? That's... but no, I think it's just it's just a bit of fun. I don't think there's anything has to be at stake.
Okay, so second game, Worf opens with 50, which he may or may not be bluffing, but we'll never know. Because we have to stop for an emergency message. The ship has to proceed to coordinates 423 by 112 by 51, which is approximately in Portland, Oregon. further orders will come by, you know, when the storyline calls for it, that is. So whenever, you know, like Picard says, whenever Starfleet gets enigmatic, he loses more hair.
Guy can't get more enigmatic than that. Be at this location.
Yes. Hey, come here. We're heading toward the Baratus system, but nobody knows why, so... but we do know that we're going to be meeting up with the emissary. Here we go. And we're supposed to cooperate fully with the envoy, who happens to be traveling in a Class 8 probe, which is just over 2 meters long, by the way. Now, they say if the transmitters and sensors were removed and life support systems were restored, it just might work. So, did I hear that wrong? Did he say restored? As in, they typically have life support systems in these things, or did he say if the transmitters and sensors were removed and the life support systems were stored in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's stored because usually they don't have life support in those type of probes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, we're just going to open this up, take all the guts out, except for the warp drive. We're going to throw life support, a basic life support system in. We're going to throw this poor person in this, and we're going to shoot them out in a direction and hope, because they have no sensors, how we got to hope that they make it to where they're supposed to make it.
Yeah, yeah, I had a question about that. I guess I can go into it now. What happens if the Enterprise was late or got picked off by a Romulan? I mean, where's that probe going to end up?
Going until it runs out of fuel or until the person runs out of air, whichever comes first.
Okay.
Basically, it's their coffin.
Right. Okay.
It's a Warp 9 coffin.
Warp 9 coffin.
Yeah, that's what I... That's why I'm like, oh my god. When I saw this episode and I saw it, I'm like, I didn't know they make coffins go that fast. Man, I gotta have one when I die. Just be able to warp... Just say I can warp out of the fuel.
Oh my goodness. Wouldn't that be something if we could figure out a way to find a coffin that looks like a probe with the holders on the side?
Actually, they do make them here in Indiana, in Muncie. There's a they make wooden coffins, and they'll custom make any coffin to any specifications for the right amount of money.
Jeez! I'm going to have to increase my life insurance policy. I want that. Anyway, okay.
Complete with all the trimming.
So hang on, Luce, are you not going for the Ira Graves look?
Yeah. No, I don't want the window in there. Nitpick alert. Nitpick alert.
Nitpick alert. Nitpick alert. Nitpick alert. This is a Battle Bridge. Nitpick alert. If you or anyone in your family is a member of the Borg, please proceed with caution. Perfection does not apply.
But like I said, how in the world was the torpedo supposed to get there without no guidance system to get it there in the first place?
That's my nitpick alert. It's one thing is I don't understand how could it possibly travel at warp 9. I would think you'd have to have some pretty sophisticated warp technology, you know, like a warp drive, nacelles, anything. How can it just go at warp?
Yeah, that's also a very interesting question.
Now, I have to say, I mean, personally, I don't buy the idea that it can go up warp. I just find that it's not... I think it goes against too much you see elsewhere, that you could have a fully functional warp drive inside a probe, and then you would also need deflectors and stuff like that so you don't smash into things. However, having said all of this, you know, I'm actually going to give this mode of travel a pass because I think it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the concept behind it, and it kind of makes sense, although, you know, an extra 6 hours on, you know, a mission that he probably had at least a couple of weeks notice on. But, you know, I like it, and I think it's nice, since they don't do this very often, and I think in this episode at least it was a cool way of introducing the character.
Hmm. Let me ask you another question about this envoy, why she had to be transported like this. All Admiral Grummick would say was, you'll understand when the envoy briefs you. What was the problem? Okay, we have a ship of Klingons that are coming out of stasis, and you need to go find them easily enough. I mean, what are they worried about? Romulan eavesdropping? Catch them first or something?
No, they were worried about the Klingons themselves might be awake and catching the transmission.
Oh, that makes sense.
That's why they sent the envoy.
I would doubt the 23rd century Klingons would have decryption methods of the 24th century Starfleet.
Or a radical group of 24th century Klingons knew that there was some Klingons who haven't changed their philosophy about the Federation. They go rescue them instead.
Well, they do obviously have information that the Empire wants. So, okay. So now here's another nitpick alert. Okay, when the probe is beamed aboard the ship, wouldn't it be just way too cold for O'Brien to just, you know, touch it and open it up? Or do you think the transporter warms it up to the human touch?
Okay, why do you think the probe would be cold?
Because it's in space, and everything in space is cold.
No, that's not true. So,
get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya.
I'm sorry. So you often see this, right, in sci-fi, where you have, of course, space itself is cold, and there are cold parts of space. Mm-hmm. Clearly, sitting next to a sun, you're not going to be cold. But the main way, so let's say that you're ejected into space, the main way that you're going to lose your energy or lose your heat when you're on Earth is not through, it's basically through a convection. So you lose it against the wind, and then the wind takes it away, and then you cool down. So this is why it's always colder to stand when the wind's there than it when there isn't any wind. The thing is, when you're in space, that it's a vacuum. So when you're actually put out there, you can't lose your heat very quickly. So the only way you can actually lose your heat is through radiation, and that's actually a relatively slow process. So whenever you see people being thrown out into space and almost instantaneously freeze, it's usually, you know, that's not the way it would happen. Mm. Now, having said that, this probe has been going for a couple of you know, hours at least. It is probably going to be cold. But I'm just challenging the image that we all often see about the guys freezing to death very, very quickly.
Yeah, but wouldn't the warp happen. Wouldn't the warp bubble that it's moving along in, wouldn't that keep it at a certain temperature too?
I think you could easily argue that, yeah.
Okay, how about when two people are in a shuttle and they lose power and they're drifting, why does it always turn cold? Or, you know, Apollo 13 on the way back, it got brutally cold.
I'm not convinced these things happen in reality, that's all.
So, oh wow, so you don't think Apollo 13 happened? Or
No, of course Apollo 13 happened, but in terms of the depiction of how quickly you lose heat.
Oh, I see.
That's all. I mean, it depends how quickly you can, you know, where does the heat go, right? Where does the energy go?
Right.
And if you're relatively well insulated and no one's going to be able to take your heat away, then, you know, it doesn't just fly out into a vacuum. It stays with you unless you can irradiate it. And that process is generally slow. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't happen eventually. Of course it does. But the instant freeze certainly isn't anything that would happen in reality.
Oh, yeah. I suppose it would take a while. Okay. So anyway, when O'Brien opens up the tube, did anybody notice that you could see Kalar's eyes inside the mask?
Nope.
Huh. And really, when I first saw that, I actually thought they were beaming aboard a robot.
Yeah, because the mask made it look like it was a robot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Dr. Pulaski says the readings are quite interesting, and as soon as she takes off that mask, Noch ne kach ness! I believe that was what she Riker said. Is that close there, Brian?
Sounds about right.
Okay. And it turns out to be a Klingon woman. Half Klingon, half human. Kind of like B'Elanna.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm going to get to something quickly. I have it somewhere in my notes. I don't know where. Who do we like better in the half-Klingon, half-human women? Kalar or B'Elanna?
Kalar, definitely.
Yeah? Why?
Kalar uses her half-human, half-Klingon more as a bad punchline. Mm-hmm. Where B'Elanna, she just flat out trying to out-muscle her own Klingon side. And she don't really truly embrace it until way later in the Voyager. Mm-hmm. Where Susi understand it. I mean, yeah, you know who I'm talking about. Understood her Klingon side well, and she kind of used her, what's the best way? She kind of used sarcasm to deal mm-hmm. with it.
Yeah.
Okay, kind of like what I do sometimes. I'll use sarcasm to deal with that rambunctious, evil, nasty, argumentative side of me. Okay.
Doc, who do you prefer?
I think this is an unfair question because I really, you know, when you were summing up the episode and you didn't like the, you know, you mentioned that you liked the Klingon story, but you weren't mm-hmm. overly keen by the introduction of at least a love interest side of the story. When I, you know, rewatching this, I actually really appreciated, you know, Susie Plaxton's portrayal of Kalar here. And I think this is, perhaps my memory is not not the best, but I think this is probably one of the, I think this is the first instance of the one of the co-stars, one of the guest stars, kind of really carrying the show. And I actually thought her performance was very, very good. So I've, you know, just coming out of watching this, I'm betting for Team Kalar at this point.
Yeah, I agree with you. Kalar was an excellent, excellent character. I think if they had changed her storyline a little, maybe the fact that she was at one time with Worf and that's something they needed to deal with, but not more than half the episode. It just went on too far. I think if she had helped the ship find the Klingons, and then, like I said, the cat and mouse game between they've cloaked. Oh, we can't find them now. We got to go here and we got to go there and find them. They attack a couple star bases, and I thought it would be more interesting then. And we still could have had a little bit of the Kalar meets up with the old Flame Worf, but in the end, I kind of like B'Elanna more. We get, I guess it's because we get more of her backstory and her relationship with Tom Paris. That was just simply awesome. It's a lot better than the Kalar Worf relationship, to be honest.
Well, give Kalar some credit though. To be an ambassador in the Klingon Empire, you got to be a pretty ballsy girl, okay? Much as a pretty ballsy man, okay? So to be the be a Klingon ambassador, I think she was Earth's ambassador, if I remember right.
Well, she's a Klingon ambassador to the Federation.
The Federation, yeah. That's no small task to get that job. I mean, she really had to be good at what she did in order to get that honor. So you can't just ignore it. I just wish they would have gave her more, like they did with B'Elanna Torres. They should have given her more time. Let us see more about who she was more. Mm-hmm. That was the only downside to her, to Susie's character. And I think if they would have not wrote her off in later episodes, I think she would have been a great add-on down the line to see Worf and her actually become a couple and to have her on more on TNG.
Yeah.
But they didn't think like that back then when they did this. And Susie got wrote out in later episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. And she went out like a proper Klingon, too. I will have to give her credit.
Oh, yeah,
for it.
Of course. Okay. So we were 12 minutes into the episode before we really get into the storyline of Starbase 336 received an automated signal from a Klingon ship, the Tong. Not the salad tongs, by the way. A ship that was sent out over 75 years ago, and the message says the ship is returning home and is about to reach its awakening point. So obviously the crew are in cryogenic sleep for the voyage. And when they wake up, they will be within slaughter distance of several Federation colonies. And, you know, that's obviously lucky number 13 colonies with minimal defense, and the sheep aboard them would be no match for the Klingons. So where to begin with the questions? Okay.
Well, my first question is, these guys were sent 75 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. In 75 years, these guys haven't bettered their defenses by then? Come on.
Yeah, that's exactly.
That was my that was the first thing I looked at it when they said this. I said, what are these guys? Like, you don't even consider the fact that you got to have some defenses on some of these outposts somewhere. I mean, what are they, just drop down farming communities,
right,
or something?
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Nice.
I think one of them was a research center, if I remember right, of some of them.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if they really ever described that, but still, nice ripe targets. No Federation ships with 24th century technology that could stop a 23rd century Klingon ships are in the area. None of them. Colonies with minimal defenses. I would imagine that even a 24th century technology colony could still defend itself against a 23rd century Klingon ship. But I mean, here's another thing. Even if it wasn't that Klingon ship, what if the Pakleds just went bat crap crazy and decided to pick off a few colonies?
That's what I said. I just couldn't figure out how in the world would these colonies be worried about a 100-year-old ship? Okay, I mean, it isn't going to have the same fight. It'd be like sending the NCC 1701 out to go raid out there. They wouldn't stand it. The Enterprise would get blown out of the water. At the minimum, defensive people. Come on, guys, get real here.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, I think the Enterprise obviously could have stopped them in a second if they needed to. Here's another question, though, unless Doc wants to expand on these.
No, keep rolling. Okay. Keep rolling.
Why would the Klingon Empire simply launch a ship with cryogenic warriors in the first place? What was the point?
Well, to kind of answer that one, the only thing I can figure out is that they figured that they might be still battling the Federation by that time, or the cryogenics didn't wake up when it was supposed to. Those are the only two reasons I can come up with on why they would send a ship out in cryogenics, because it was cloaked, so the cloaking device still worked during that whole time frame. Okay. Why send a cloak ship out to this area unless they were intentionally getting ready to attack that and the cryogenics didn't start back up, or they figuring that they were still going to be at war 75 years from now? It would be behind Federation lines where nobody would be around to defend it, and they could go in and raid and plunder as they saw fit.
That's a good point. Okay. Then as our... I still call you our resident Klingon. We don't know of any other Klingons that come on the show, so you're still a resident Klingon. If the ship is destroyed while the crew is in cryo sleep, is that still an honorable death? If it gets hit by a meteorite or something?
Well, in their mind, yeah, they would still be an honorable death because they were going out to do their duty.
Ah, for the Empire.
For the Empire, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, so Picard... Okay, I'm done with my questions. Anybody got any other questions on this?
The only other thing I got is that why in the world would they... I still couldn't figure out why they would still send her in a torpedo. Why not just send a ship?
There were no ships available. So they launched an emissary from a starbase where there were no ships available. Why ain't there ships all over star bases? What's the point of having a star base with no ships?
Yeah.
Well, obviously it's for story. That's all.
And then the Klingon ship that's supposed to rendezvous with them takes longer to get there. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
By the way, if you didn't recognize the name, we'll hear that ship's name again several more times in at least one more time in the show.
The Tong or what ship?
The ship that was coming to get the Tong.
The Prang?
Is it the Prang, the one that Riker was on?
No, he was on the...
Oh.
Okay, so Picard assigns Worf to work with the emissary, who really really doesn't want to. Are there any personal reasons why? Yeah. Any professional reasons? No. Well, I could think of a professional reason, because she and I had a relationship, and I think it's going to compromise the work. That's pretty professional, right? I mean, they're not going to get anything done if they're biting each other all the time.
It's the Klingons. Klingons won't say, well, yeah, it might be a little personal, but professional will work around it. And that, to me, is stupid.
Okay, here's something I want to have to talk about. Now, Doc can verify this. I don't like to spout memory alpha here. Whenever I hear podcasters do it, it kind of makes me cringe because I could read all that myself. I want their opinion on the show, not what memory alpha says.
Okay, Lou, I hear a but.
But I am going to in this time because I want us to discuss it. Not necessarily a revelation. Did you know that... Actually, they were going to have a relationship between Worf and Dr. Salar, the Vulcan.
But
it was changed. Now, let's throw memory alpha out the door and forget that now. Which do you think...
One second. Was that a joke? Or was that... Was that what you've read on Memory Alpha?
No, it is actually what they were considering was having him have a relationship with Dr. Salar, played by Susie. Okay. So I guess it would have been more interesting is what they say. Okay, they're out the door. Now, what do we think? I think they're absolutely right. What if Worf had a relationship with Dr. Salar? what do you think, Doc?
So Worf having a relationship with Dr. Salar, I think is a stupid idea.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. How would that even happen, or even how?
Well, I mean, obviously, back in their past, they would have had something.
Yeah, that's basically what Worf would have had dating Dr. Salar would have been a headache.
Exactly.
I mean, in my opinion, the idea of Dr. Salar and Worf getting together in any type of relationship, to me, doesn't make sense. I couldn't see a Vulcan, or even the Klingon, being attracted in that direction.
Exactly. I think that's why it would make sense to me. It would be the odd couple. It would be so funny to see the play between the two. I mean, Worf and Deanna made absolutely zero sense. But, I mean, a Vulcan and a Klingon? I mean, it's not necessarily Worf and Salar. It's a Vulcan and a Klingon. That in itself...
It's an oxymoron.
Yes, it would be so funny to how they could possibly have hooked up at one time, and then they come back. You know, they're back together on this ship, kind of like Deanna and Riker, only a Vulcan and a Klingon. That'd be funny.
Okay.
You just can't mix an illogical Klingon with an illogical Klingon with a logical Vulcan. It just doesn't happen. Trust me, I have this problem already. I don't have to. I can tell from experience. It's not going to happen. Okay. It's impossible.
Do you think there's much Klingon Vulcan / fiction out there?
I wouldn't know. But my guess is no.
So to see a Klingon and a Vulcan do something, it's like a bad rock.
All right. Well, anyway, we better go on.
Trust me, the only way it would work is if the Vulcan wasn't logical. In other words, if they hadn't went through to purge their emotions and they were emotional Vulcan, then it might be able to work. Mm. Okay, but
no.
The logical Klingon, I mean the logical Vulcan and an illogical Klingon would never exist. One would kill the other somewhere along the line just because one or the other would get frustrated with them.
Is there a slight chance of a logical Klingon being out there, like a real kind of nerdy Klingon that's a bookworm? Any chance of that?
Most you got to keep in mind, and they show this in later episodes with other Klingons who were in the scientific community. Klingons view their caste like the warriors view themselves. Okay, they don't always are logical. They're not without emotions. Where Vulcans tend to hide or suppress their emotions would be a better phrase. Mm-hmm. So Klingons got to have that emotion as well with the thing. So to see them interact with an illogical Vulcan would be like, oh god, this is going to be like a bad soap opera. It's going to be boring and ridiculous because they're always going to be logical about it. And it's like sometimes they like to fight, even if it's just a good argument. Okay, and you just don't get that with the Vulcans as well as you would any other species. I guess it's the best way I can translate for everybody and make sense of it.
Well, they don't like to fight, but they sure love to argue.
Well, they love to fight, too, and that would be the other problem. Because them going into the holodeck like what would happen here later on, and fighting together is also part of the whole thing. The Vulcan would almost have to be somewhat emotional to be able to work with the Klingon, and I'm sorry, Vulcans are not willing to give up that much emotion to make a relationship like that work. Because even when we saw Spock's mother, she was quite logical and she didn't really express much emotion, okay, because she had to learn to adapt herself to that.
Okay.
Okay. In private, she probably was very emotional, but when she was out in the general public, you could almost put pointy ears on her and she could almost pass as a Vulcan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because her husband trained her.
Right, but that's my whole point. Klingons, they got to have that fire. And Vulcans just don't have that fire because they don't have no emotion, or very little emotion, I should say.
Okay, let's. Here's another thing I wonder if anybody noticed. Did anybody notice what Kalar was wearing that it looked very Bajoran-like?
Yeah, the uniform she came in on.
Yeah, I noticed. I don't know if Doc saw that. It looked very Bajoran uniformish.
I thought it looked quite Klingonish, personally, but.
Are we talking like the spandex first one, or the kind of like the more leathery, kind of like a red suit?
To see that one, the second one when she goes to smash the table.
Okay, I don't know. Yeah,
check it out.
I don't know. No, I know which of the suits it is, and in fact, I do have it up at the moment. I'm not sure. I think it looks pretty Klingon-y.
Really? I thought it looked more because of the what looks like a sweater that only goes around the arms type of thing. That looks very Bajoran-ish.
Okay, sure.
So anyway, I also noticed that just moments before she smashes a glass table, she was breathing through her teeth. Like, and I think later Alexander does the same thing.
So. Yeah, no, yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah, you are. She's just so mad she just can't. She can just vent and fire out of every hole she got.
Yeah, but I'm saying that later on, if Alexander does the same thing, something like that, I think it's
right through his teeth.
I think it would. It's an interesting callback to this episode if they did that. I don't know if they did or not, but so Deanna suggests that instead of busting the ship's furniture, Kalar should go to the holodeck and work off her frustration. So she chooses the calisthenics program of Lieutenant Worf. Now, question here. Can anybody simply choose someone else's program and run it? Or what happens if someone runs across a program called The Cure for a Lonely Night by Lieutenant Commander LaForge, or a program simply called the Riker Maneuver?
Okay. You can place certain programs where it's accessible only to you, and you can place certain programs that are accessible to everybody. Mm. That part of the holodeck I know you can do. So Worf's calisthenic thing was probably set for general usage by anyone in the crew.
Ah.
You notice they had different settings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, had setting one, setting two, yeah. I think setting three, I think is...
It has to.
Yeah. Okay, setting one was a pretty tough fight for a Fetty. So, and they went up to level two where it got even more...
Yes, that was an interesting one too. Because I also have another thing that I don't know if anybody caught, but I didn't. I actually did not catch this until today when I watched this. I got some things going on, and I wasn't able to watch this episode till today. But I also noticed that on level two, when Worf was fighting one of the monsters, he was grunting. The monster was grunting. It's the exact same sound that Anya made when she turned into that red bug-eyed monster in sickbay and attacked Worf. So it's interesting that both times we hear that growl of the monster, they're attacking Worf.
You'll find Hollywood will reuse virtually everything.
Oh yeah,
even sound effects.
You ever see the series Emergency from the 70s? You know, Johnny and Roy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Netflix if you got it. Listen to it when the fire trucks go out to a scene. You can hear background sounds, and it's on a repeating loop. I don't know why they do this, but you know, you can hear one firefighter saying, "Hey, give me a hand over here," and then you hear them all go, "Row, row, row," and it just repeats over and over. And I don't know if I have OCD or what, But I hear that every time I watch the show now. I hear that, hey, get me in over here. It doesn't matter what they're doing. You hear it all the time. It's annoying. So, yes, I know what you mean by they use the same sounds over and over again.
Lou, very quickly, would you like to hear my OCD joke?
Go ahead.
It's not quite an OCD joke, but I don't have OCD. I have CDO, which is like OCD, but the letters are alphabetical, as they should be.
As they should be.
apologies
just,
for that.
Oh, don't. It's good. I was just thinking of a good memory joke because I don't have a good memory. So, you know, I could ask the question, do you know how a guy with bad memory helps remember things?
Post-it notes.
Do you know how a guy with bad memory remembers things? Hey, I got one for you. Do you know how a guy with a bad memory remembers things? Oh, wait. Anyway, that's stupid. Yours was better, Doc. Anyway, so that was, of course, a callback to the, I call it the dolphin. James calls it the...
Dolphin.
Dolphin.
Because it's French.
It's French.
Oui, oui.
Oui, oui. Okay. Let's see. I did like the visual effect of Worf slicing the monster in half, and he just, his top half just kind of falls. That was pretty cool.
And then dematerializes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but my question is, when Kalar was fighting them in the first round, why didn't they do the same thing in the first round? All they did was lay down on the ground and die.
Well,
they did.
Yeah.
Until she hit the second level, they were still there on the ground or wherever she murdered them at.
Yeah, murder.
Okay.
Can you murder a hologram?
Okay. But then when they went to the next level, when they killed them, they actually disappeared and left.
Did they? I thought it was just the one that got sliced in half that disappeared.
No.
Oh, I must have missed that part. I really wasn't watching that part, but I love that. So, anyway, after they attack the monsters and kill them all, it's time to mate. And this is very interesting, you know, how all you have to do is just grab her arm and sniff it and then bury her fingernails into the palm of her hand and then she's pregnant? Must be.
No, no, that's just...
they cut away for the next part.
No. That's not the marriage part. That's just two people wanting to get together and do the wild thing.
Yeah, the mating part, not the marriage.
Okay, the funky. They basically just took some funky cold Medina,
and then,
Klingon style.
Yes, and then when they come back from the commercial after they're done with their Klingon exploits, her hand is perfectly healed. So, I mean, obviously they ran to sickbay to get, you know, that fixed, but...
No, they just didn't show it.
Here's another thing for him. Out of nowhere, Worf decides he's going to take the oath. No official needs to be present, no judge, no clergy, nothing. All you have to do is simply say the words, Tehengon Ji! But if she says no... then you have to amp it up a little bit by reminding her that you are Klingons. And just as she's about to leave, you have to change those oath the word and make it Tahingon Ji or Tahongon Ji or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
Is it that easy to get married?
Yep. And it's that easy to get divorced, too.
Oh, that is so true. DS9. Yes. The House of Quark. All she did was spit on him and slap him and, hey, you're done. But still...
backhand him, spit on him, and said, we're divorced.
Yeah, but still, the point is how can that be legal? I mean...
because you fall back to that nasty five-letter word that Klingons like to use all the time. It's called H-O-N-O-R. It's called honor.
Honor.
Okay, so who's going to question the honor of a Klingon when he says that we took the oath? Okay?
Duras, you did
because, yeah, that's what screwed it up because he took the oath right before she died, and he went in and claiming mate, he couldn't question it because who's going to question Worf? Mm-hmm. Okay, And Worf basically did what Worf has the right to do.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Where are we at here? Oh, and of course, Wesley's not at Con. I don't know why. I mean, it didn't explode or anything. So obviously he was busy that day. Did you notice a guy at the tactical station while Worf was getting his to hang on G on?
No. Who was it?
His name is Dietrich Bader. And Bader. And he's actually one of the guys that Doctor didn't introduce. There was a couple co-stars. Anne Elizabeth Ramsey as Ensign Clancy. And Dietrich Bader as a tactical crewman. Now, he played Oswald on the Drew Carey Show, and also he was Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies. But actually, if you want to see him in a pretty funny movie, I don't know. I'm sure I've talked about Office Space, haven't I, Doc?
I don't recall.
Well, and if you can let me tangent just a minute. I know that U.S. and U.K. don't really cross-pollinate movies, but you've got...
We've been so tight up until now, Luke.
Yes, we have. But you've got to get Office Space. If you work in a cubicle anywhere...
Oh, no, I have seen the film.
Oh, good.
But I haven't heard you talk about it in this case.
Okay, well, anybody who hasn't seen the film, if you work in a cubicle, you owe it to yourself to watch this movie. So anyway, he plays Peter's next-door neighbor. And another guy who plays in this... or plays on that movie as well, and I'm trying to pull up Fairhaven, but I believe he played Seamus, Richard Reihle. You know, he's a Saints Preservers Tommy Boy. He was also on Office Space as well. So, anyway, back to the story. An android chaperone.
Yeah. Oh, that's a pretty pathetic Klingon when you gotta bring an android chaperone.
That was funny though. Okay. But okay, that, I mean, because they just extend the argument a little more and Data's in the middle going, could we carry on the petty bickering, please? Oh, that's later. Okay. So here's our...
Well, I think what pissed me off more about all this is that she didn't even try to even come up with a conceptual idea of trying to work around it. All her thought was just blow the ship up and be done with it, and let's get back. There's no sense of saving these Klingons. Let them die an honorable death.
Yeah,
and in a sense, she's right. If it would have been the other way around and the Klingon ship was going out to get them... They would have shot him right out of the water and gave him
a no choice. But there. But let's talk about
those. No. They wouldn't have. It wouldn't have been a choice. They would have just went ahead and shot him and given them an honorable death.
Yeah.
Period. Okay. Just because they're Klingons.
Yeah.
She's in her right mind. She's right. Yeah. The mentality she took about dealing with this was what most Klingons would have done. Worf did have a point that sometimes there are better ways of dealing with the situation than shoot it and ask questions later.
Right.
Possibly.
Yeah. Well, let's discuss the two options that they came up with. Find the ship before it awakens, simply give them a little more Ambien and keep them sleeping. Or the second option was they've already awakened and, you know, they have no choice but to destroy it. But we'll find out later there was a third option. Yes. Here's a saying. If the road ahead of you cuts into two directions, take the third path. That's what we'll find out. So we find the ship. What do you think of the music score while they encounter the ship? Anybody notice it?
Kind of. I was more interested on how they were trying to track down the ship.
I mean, it wasn't as good as the Defector music, but it was pretty awesome. I thought it was pretty appropriate for finding the Klingon ship. Okay, so Data concludes that the ship might still be asleep. I mean, doesn't seem like there's anything going on aboard it. That is, of course, until they fire on the Enterprise, but then he says, well, he could be in error. Oh, that Data, what a card. So here comes LaForge to the bridge. Engineering, transfer to the bridge. Have we ever discussed that, really? Because I think this is one of the first few times that he's done it. Or he did it earlier in season two, but engineering, transfer to the bridge. What does that mean? Everybody in engineering gets to take a break? He's got the control?
No, he's got the final... He's got a certain set of controls that he functions with. And he moves them up to the bridge so he can monitor what's going on down there, and then all the subordinates are down there doing what he's doing, what their normal jobs would be in a battle situation, which to me is stupid. If you're going to have a problem in engineering, the one place you need to have your chief engineers at isn't on the bridge of the Enterprise. It's supposed to be down in the engineering room.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Never seen Scotty hardly ever come up and deal with something unless
it
was... No,
not true. Scotty was in that chair a lot. But I was thinking that none of the drop-in chief engineers of Season 1 did it.
No.
Yeah.
Just LaForge.
Yeah, just LaForge. And, you know, I guess Scotty, because he had to be there hiding that missing finger of his. Okay. So... Now we come up with a third option. But to do this, we have to change command of the ship. Do you think they went through the whole ceremony of changing command?
No.
No.
Because Picard and Riker were both in the captain's ready room.
Yeah, watching the whole thing. Watching
the whole thing. What they did was, is they just basically, Worf came up with that option while they were sitting there trying to track him down and decide whether they were going to shoot him or not. And that's when Worf came up with the idea, we got two Klingons on board. Why don't we just make them look like they're in command of the ship and force the ship to stand down? If they don't, then we'll shoot them out of the water anyway, and Worf gets to blow them out of the water.
That's not true. Good point. A Klingon gets to be the one to send them to Stovall.
And gives them, and thank you. They die with honor. They die with better honor because a Klingon killed them and not what their mind was a Federation ship.
So what do we think of the solution? Obviously, we got your opinion. You like it, and so do I. Doctor, what about you?
I thought it was really good. I didn't see it coming. I think I've put down that I like the switcheroo where they take Picard and Riker off the bridge and they put the two Klingons there. I think it's good. I didn't see it coming, and I also particularly like the way that Worf behaves. He behaves Klingon with the other Klingons, so he stands up to them a lot more, and he's very kind of assertive, and you know he grows tired of explaining it to them, and he's prepared to kill them, and I think it's very in keeping with his character, or in particular, it's very in keeping with the character we know Worf will later become. So I thought it was very well done.
Yeah, and then they played into the card game that from the beginning of the show. The Iceman. Yep. Okay. Worf did a great job playing a Klingon commanding officer.
Mm-hmm.
Did a fabulous job. He just sat there, and it was not that hard for him, really, because he already knew what he was going to do and what was going to go. He just had to convince the hard-headed captain that he was actually a Klingon captain. Okay, and once he understood he was the bigger the ship, the senior the officer. In this case, the Enterprise is definitely a lot bigger than a D7 battlecruiser. So who's in charge?
Bigger the ship?
Worf.
Bigger the ship, the bigger the rank? Is that what
the
you
higher
said?
The rank.
Really?
The
I've never noticed rank. That.
If you ever look and if you ever research when there's a chain of command issue, and I use Janeway and the other one back. I can't think of that Federation ship, the research ship.
And the Equinox. Okay.
Yeah. When they decide who's the senior in command between two captains of equal rank, it's the most combat-ready ship. Okay, it'd be like taking the Intrepid and the Galaxy-class ship. Who would be the senior captain in this situation? Who's ever the CEO of the Galaxy class starship?
Yep.
Okay, because it's more combat capability than the Intrepid class. Same thing when the Equinox was in the Delta Quadrant. Janeway was the senior captain.
Yeah.
By default, because she had the more combat-ready ship.
Okay.
Okay, right. It's basically the same thing in the Klingon Empire. If you're in charge, if you're in command of a Nekvar-class battlecruiser, you're either on the High Council or you're the Chancellor of the Klingon Empire. If you're in a Vorchod, then you're a very senior captain. Okay, and if you're in a Kavort or something, you're just one of the major, you're just a good commanding officer. If you're in a Borel, you're a brand new captain, or you've one that's been dishonored so bad the only thing they deserve to fly around in is a garbage scout ship.
God. Okay, here's a question then. I'm just curious. Kalar obviously had higher rank as ambassador. Why didn't she become captain and put Worf on her side?
Because Klingons, you don't usually have female captains in charge of ships. They are usually 99.9% male.
You can't rule your own house. You can't be a captain on a ship.
Right.
Fascinating.
That's basically the whole if and or buts about it. Okay. You'll see them be executive officers.
Yeah,
but you very rarely will see a female be a commanding officer.
Okay,
and if you do see them, it's because it's a House Defense Force, not the actual Imperial Klingon military.
Got it. Okay, and of course, Worf's option does work. Captain Katemach yields command of the Tong to Worf, who sends Kalar to command the ship. So actually, she did take over as the ship's captain to send him back to Kronos. And, Captain, welcome to the 24th century.
Bravo! Yeah, that's cynicism.
Yeah, I know. And, of course,
I'm about ready to blow you up. Welcome to the 24th century, Captain.
What was Worf's opinion of the captain chair? Comfortable chair. Which, really, I don't think is true. Because how could it be a comfortable chair? It's got padding on it. Klingons don't want that. I mean, he should have ripped the padding off and sat on a brick. You'd have been happy with that.
Even the captain's chairs have some padding on it.
Yeah, that's not good. Okay. So, Worf escorts Kalar to the transporter room and sends O'Brien packing. I'll relieve you. What? Oh, yes, Lieutenant. And of course, there was a little bit back and forth, and that was a pretty cool ending line, you know, Kalar, I will not be complete without you. Oh, how sweet, Worf.
Poor man's ever complete. He got married and lost his wife.
Oh, they didn't get married. Oh, well, that's the next episode that they actually get married in, but not this one.
I've had two marriages and both end up with the mate being killed. God, that man, I wouldn't want to beat the next bride of war.
No kidding. All right, well, if you've got...
Because he lost Judge Zia.
Well, that's later, yeah.
Yeah, and he lost Kalar. Yep. I mean, I wouldn't want to be the bride of Worf.
He's lucky. Lucky guy.
That's almost as bad as the bride of Frankenstein.
Well, unless you guys have anything else, I think we should go into our final thoughts and ratings for this.
That's fine by me.
Okay, yes. It's a little after 10 o'clock in Jamesville. Okay, so it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being poo-poo and 5 being kapla, success. For me, let's go to the Klingon first. Klingon, what do you think of your Klingon show?
Well, I like the interaction of, we got to see how Klingons find foreplay interesting. Oh, that's being nice and G-rated.
Yeah.
Or can we go to the PG rating?
Well, we got your meaning. Go on.
Okay. And I liked the way that Worf finally figured out a way to bring an honorable Klingon ship back to the Empire. But overall, I'm giving it a 3.5. I just can't give it a 4 completely, but I can't just give it a 3 neither. So 3.5 for me.
Okay, 3.5. And James?
By the way, I always like when you get one of us to give you a number, we can hear you put it into Excel. He said, 3.5, I'll type that up on my typewriter.
Matter of fact, I've already determined what your score will be, and I will see if I'm right. Go on.
Well, I think you have to let us know. Although, I suppose if you do let me know, then I can always change it.
No, I can't
just
do
to
that.
Prove you wrong. So I never used to really like this episode as as a kid, and maybe I just didn't appreciate the kind of the love story interest. Maybe it's a little bit slow. But rewatching, I enjoyed it more than I remembered. I would like to highlight, I think Susie Plaxton is very good. I think she carries the show, and I think that she interacts very well with Worf, and also has a couple of good moments with Deanna Troi as well. When she breaks the table and so are your empathic abilities telling you that I'm upset? He said, yes, that and the table. You know, that's a quite nice line. I enjoyed the... I like the backstory that this gives to Worf, and I think that we can see that early on in TNG, it's really Worf that is getting a lot of this, you know, this character development, whereas others are effectively standing still. I think that we've learned more about Worf than probably anyone else on the show so far. So that's good. I found it funny that these two effectively mate over the in the holodeck, which is more or less the Klingon equivalent of wooing the wife whilst playing Call of Duty or something like that. Which I thought was was good. I've mentioned already. I quite like the way that they solve it at the end. That's nice. I think there are a lot of bits and pieces around here. I think overall it doesn't quite fit together as a great episode. And I am pretty much with Brian in terms of thinking it's somewhere between a 3 and a 4, but I don't do half points, so I'm going to unfortunately bring it down to a 3. I think it's a solid episode, better than I remember, and a 3 from me. And I really appreciate that, obviously, Susie comes back in just over a year's time, and we get a continuation of this story, although the offspring attached is a little bit more annoying than he should be.
Mm. Yeah. He's just not Molly O'Brien annoying.
There's nothing wrong with Molly O'Brien.
Yes, there is.
No, there is. We're going to have serious fallings out when we get to Keiko and Molly. Keiko is wonderful, and Molly is absolutely fine.
Miles,
we'll have to have a major discussion on that.
We are still 5 seasons away from deciding if we're doing DS9 or not. Which I'm still.
Well, do me a favor. When you get the episode when Miles and Keiko get married, make sure you pull me for that episode, because I'm definitely going to be opening my mouth on that one.
You want Data's day?
Yeah.
Let me see. Where is Data? Oh, it's season 4.
Season 4.
Okay.
It's a great episode.
Okay. Yeah, it is a great episode if you want to strangle Keiko and O'Brien.
You know, I'm just going to put you in for that, Brian, because you're special for us. Okay, if it wasn't for Brian, I would have been done in 2009. So, anyway, and I was right. I did peg it at a 3 for you.
Ah, okay. Lies.
Ferengis never lie. Between Ferengis. Anyway.
Yeah, right. I don't know what Snicko you're selling, but man, it's gotta be some good stuff. Pass me a bottle.
A little bit of it. Okay, so I think it's a good premise, but the execution I think was just a little bit lacking. Kalar was a little too flamboyant, but was it still an interesting character nonetheless? Having a ship full of Klingons who think the war is still going on, I thought was very interesting. And I think the whole episode could have been just on that alone. The ship that can't be easily found through its cloaking device. It would deal with the Enterprise having to hunt it down. So I would have found that better. We could still have had a little bit of Kalar and Worf. But anyway, in the end, on my version, I think the Klingon ship would have had to have been destroyed, and they would have done it, given them their honorable death. The entire Worf Kalar could have been dropped, but again, I wouldn't mind it. In fact, had they done that my way, my rating would have been higher. So anyway, I'm just thankful they didn't bust out any Klingon tea ceremony and have Worf reading love poetry.
Oh, no. Kalar would have killed him with the stuff she'd been throwing.
I could hear the audience clicking off at that point. But one thing I would have liked to have known is what those secrets were that the Klingons are taking back to the Empire. Because obviously, you know, we are on a serious mission for the Empire. You dare not destroy us. I wonder if that works. But anyway.
He was bluffing.
Of course. Maybe. But since...
No, he was bluffing.
Okay. Since this turns into almost a Klingon, silly Klingon love story, I like you, King... You guys, or like James, I'm giving it a 3 as well. But it would have been easily a 4 or more had they actually had the cat and mouse game of the Tong in the Enterprise. I think it would have been a lot better then. And if we needed to bring Kalar back to discuss the past, maybe in a different type of episode. But I think they just lost it. They lost a great premise in the 75-year ship Klingon that are on the way back and think the war is still going on. That could have been an interesting episode. Okay. Well then, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. It's nice to get on once in a while and kind of remind me of the good old days.
We do have to come up with a topic and at least pump out a Lou Trek show once in a while.
Yeah, I agree with you. By the way, I have something over at the house that you probably haven't seen but once.
Mm.
The banner.
The Klingon one or what?
No, the Lou Trek show
banner. Oh, I haven't seen that forever.
And I still have the magnetic card things that you bought, too.
How cool is that? Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard. Like Brian Baker said, we pretty much ran our course of topics. And it was just too difficult to come up with anything. But I think you and I really do need to come up with something and put out a show on occasion. Even if there has to be no set schedule, but at least something. If one of us gets a wild hair and decides to just toss on a show, I think we should for old times.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Great. Well, let's work on that. Okay, so thank you very much, Brian, for coming on, and we will see you in season 3.
Oh, no. This is it for season 2 for me. Boo.
Oh, there's only 2 episodes to go.
Oh, man, you got to have more Klingon.
Yeah, a pretty good one and then a sucky one. I'll let you guys decide which is which. So.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
The hunt begins, number one.
The crew battles each other in a simulated war game.
Computers report heavy damage to the Enterprise.
Bring us about, Ensign. Maximum shields.
But a surprise ambush traps them in a fight for survival.
That's no ghost attacking the Enterprise. That's real.
Where are my weapons?
Unavailable, sir. The connections have been fused.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
So join us next week as we review Season 2, Episode 21, Peak Performance, the good one.
Oh, God. I'm glad I'm not doing that one because I think half the show would be my opinion on that matter.
All right. So
I might just come on next week for that one just so I can give my opinion on that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have Ben, and that's what I was going to say. Coming to us from the Delta Quadrant will be Ben, who, by the way, guys, if I'm going to bring this out real quick. If you're not aware or not listening to the Delta Quadrant, they are almost to the end of their run. They only have about 6-7 episodes to go, and the Delta Quadrant is done. Not sure what they're planning to do after that, but we will maybe talk to Ben about that when he comes on next week. So take care, and good night, all.
Good night, everyone.
Kapla!